So thanks, Joan, and thanks, Chris, and thanks, White Whale and Halsey, and Anna. You're still here. Just trying to get my stuff out. Have to get arranged here. Okay, you still can hear me, right? Okay. So I'm going to be your school marm tonight, even though it's the last session of the evening. Gertrude Stein was born on February 3rd, 1874, at 850 Beach Avenue in what was then a separate municipality, Allegheny, PA, but is now considered the Allegheny West neighborhood of our dear North Side. And if you walk by there, you can see a plaque in honor of her. I wish it was a writing center, maybe someday. 37 years later, on the very same day, my mother was born in a small town in Minnesota. And 77 years later, on that exact day, I was born in Santa Barbara, California. This is why, of course, Joan asked me to do this. I doubt if my mother appreciated the significance of this coincidence, but I certainly do, and look to Gertrude Stein as both one of the greatest innovators ever working within the English language, as well as my personal literary shaman. Not that I employ Steinisms in my writing, thank God, but in terms of how she boldly forged her own courageous pedagogical path out of the Victorian era into the belly of the male-dominated world of early to mid 20th century arts and letters, she is forever my lodestar. We have so little time tonight to grapple with such a monumental figure as Gertrude Stein, and I want you all to hear a bit of her work as well as a poem inspired by her. So I'm going to rely on seminal feminist lesbian poet Judy Gron and her anthology of critical essays and excerpts from Stein's writings, really reading Gertrude Stein as our guide for this brief treatise. And this is Judy's book. I highly recommend it. Gron's book was published in 1989 and remains a preeminent source for anyone truly interested in opening one's linear-driven mind to Stein, as well as to the capabilities of language if approached from perspectives other than emotion-driven narrative. Gron begins her book's opening treatise with the following. When a person, and especially a woman, calls herself great or the greatest of writers, that is, of idea formers, this is a signal to pay her some attention, since either she is lying or she is telling the truth. And if she is lying, we shall know it soon, as her work quickly fades and her effect never materializes. But if she is telling the truth, her work will gradually expand its influence and power within our culture. Gertrude Stein said that she was great, at least the writer of our century, meaning the 20th century. And others have said that she is comparable to, say, Spinoza, and still others have belittled her and trivialized her work. My intention for this evening, for those of you who haven't yet gotten down with Gertrude, is to ignite your curiosity and entice you to dive into Stein, especially her philosophy about writing, art, and human nature. Her queerness, lifestyle, and some of her controversial stances on the sociological and political issues of her time are well documented elsewhere and have been picked apart by many scholars and pundits. So do not expect me to re-examine those tonight. Rather, simply open your ears, and as John Ashbery has said when queried about his own often abstruse poetry, I don't think it's difficult if one lets a poem approach one the way one hears music. Just let it wash over you. So that is the first thing I suggest, to just let Gertrude wash over you. The second is to read, if you haven't already, the marvelously engaging and name-dropping autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, hopefully out loud to someone. It's a gas. as that will set the Steinian mise-en-scene for the years of artistic disruption in Paris in the first half of the 20th century, and then pick up Judy Grand's thoughtful primer. I believe if you absorb these two sources, you will be born again as a fan of Stein forevermore. I consider Stein more of a philosopher who writes than a writer who philosophizes. As Grand states in her book, Stein is a writer in ideas, not judgments. They are the thread and fabric of her works. Here are some terms Grand has coined for examining Stein's work, all of which are readily apparent once the reader decides to no longer resist her rhythms and methodologies. Equality, commonality, essence, value, continual present, play, and transformation. As legend tells us, Gertrude became fast friends with Picasso and the other painters living and painting in Montmartre at the beginning of the 20th century, but Gertrude's favorite painter was Cézanne, very much pre-Picasso and often identified as the instigator of post-impressionism or the transition from impressionism to modernism. He put forth a radical theory that everything on the canvas had common importance and composed paintings accordingly. This theory of equality or lack of hierarchy in composition was adapted by Stein and became the bedrock of her writing intention and style. According to Gertrude, all the words in a sentence have equal import. Stein's 1922 story of queerness, before our present understanding of the word existed, or our present meaning of the word gay existed, Miss Fur and Miss Skeen is evidence of her harmonizing a vocabulary and giving events value in and of themselves, of giving all elements of the story equal weight. By doing so, Stein was able to write a story about behaviors at that time considered immoral, decadent, and obscene, but get it published in an era, as Grand states, that would never have published a literal version. Here are the opening paragraphs of Miss Fur and Miss Skeen. Listen for repetition, emphasizing a lack of sensationalism, giving the same-sex proclivities of Miss Fur and Miss Skeen a mundane, everyday, or quotidian, sort of gloss. And I gotta get hydrated for this. Miss Fur and Miss Skeen. Helen Fur had quite a pleasant home. Mrs. Fur was quite a pleasant woman. Mr. Fur was quite a pleasant man. Helen Fur had quite a pleasant voice, a voice quite worth cultivating. She did not mind working. She worked to cultivate her voice. She did not find it gay living in the same place where she had always been living. She went to a place where some were cultivating something, voices and other things needing cultivating. She met Georgine Skeen there, who was cultivating her voice, which some thought was quite a pleasant one. Helen Fur and Georgine Skeen lived together then. Georgine Skeen liked traveling. Helen Fur did not care about traveling. She liked to stay in one place and be gay there. They were together then and traveled to another place and stayed there and were gay there. They stayed there and were gay there. Not very gay there, just gay there. They were both gay there. They were regularly working there, both of them cultivating their voices there. They were both gay there. Georgine Skeen was gay there, and she was regular. Regular in being gay, regular in not being gay, regular in being a gay one who was not one being gay longer than was needed to be one being quite a gay one. They were both gay then, there, and both working there then. They were, in a way, both gay there, where there were many cultivating something. They were both regular in being gay there. Helen Fur was gay there. She was gayer and gayer there. And really, she was just gay there. She was gayer and gayer there. That is to say, she found ways of being gay there that she was using in being gay there. She was gay there, not gayer and gayer, just gay there. That is to say, she was not gayer by using the things she found there that were gay things. She was gay there, always she was gay there. They were quite regularly gay there, Helen Fur and Georgine Skeen. They were regularly gay there where they were gay. They were very regularly gay. To be regularly gay was to do every day the gay thing that they did every day. To be regularly gay was to end every day at the same time after they had been regularly gay. They were regularly gay. They were gay every day. They ended every day in the same way at the same time, and they had been every day regularly gay. Yeah, that's kind of, you can see why I'm not going to read too much of the work. Anyway, so you can really hear the rhythmic nature of Stein's writing, a very important element for her as well. As she writes in the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, Stein liked to set a sentence for herself as a sort of tuning fork and metronome, and then write to that time and tune. So these ideas and notions are but a few building blocks and examples of Stein's sprawling output over the course of nearly 50 years. She died on the operating table in the American hospital just outside Paris in the summer of 1946 at the age of 72, while being operated on for a cancerous tumor in her stomach. Stein's last words to her longtime companion, Alice Toklas, as she was being wheeled into the operating theater, have famously been reported as, "What is the answer?" When Alice replied that there was no answer, Gertrude characteristically quipped, "Then there is no question." Toklas outlived Stein by a little over 20 years and soldiered on as champion of Stein's work, but between Alice's spendthrift ways and eccentricities and the state challenges posed by members of Stein's family to the provisions of Gertrude's will that provided for her companion, Toklas died in Paris in relative poverty and obscurity in 1967. And here we are, a full century after Stein's beginning brushes with fame, and still her life and her ideas continue to engage us, perhaps now more than ever. Just look to the language poets, to Lynn Hejinian, Ron Silliman, and the likes of poet, novelist, and artist Renee Gladman. Gertrude Stein is all around us. Her legacy lives on and propagates. And I'd like to close with a terrific poem that pays tribute to Stein's legacy by another heralded Pittsburgh poet and one of my very favorites, Lynn Emanuel. And this poem, some of you may be familiar with, is called Inside Gertrude Stein. And there's a mention in this poem of a piece by Gertrude Stein called Patriarchal Poetry. So just know that when I come upon it. Okay. Inside Gertrude Stein. Right now, as I'm talking to you and as you are being talked to without let up, it is becoming clear that Gertrude Stein has hijacked me, and that this feeling that you are having now as you read this, that this is what it feels like to be inside Gertrude Stein. This is what it feels like to be a huge typewriter in a dress. Yes, I feel we have gotten inside Gertrude Stein, and of course it is dark inside the enormous Gertrude. It is like being locked up in a refrigerator lit only by a smiling rind of cheese. Being inside Gertrude is like being inside a monument made of a cloud, which is always moving across the sky, which is always moving. Gertrude is a huge galleon of cloud anchored to the ground by one small tether. Yes, I see it down there. Do you see that tiny snail glued to the tack board of the landscape? That is Alice. So I am inside. I am inside Gertrude. We belong to each other, she and I. And it is so wonderful because I have always been a thin woman inside of whom a big woman is screaming to get out. And she's out now. And if a river could type, this is how it would sound: pure and complicated and enormous. Now we are lilting across the countryside and we are talking. And if the wind could type, it would sound like this: ongoing and repetitious, abstracting and stylizing everything, like our famous haircut painted by Picasso. Because when you are inside our haircut, you understand that all the flotsam and jetsam of hairdo have been cleared away, like the forest from the New World, so that the skull can show through, grinning and feasting on the alarm it has created. I am now alarmingly inside Gertrude's head, and I am thinking that I may only be a thought that she has, that I may only be a thought she has had when she imagined that she and Alice were dead and gone and someone had to carry on the work of being Gertrude Stein. And so I am receiving from beyond the grave radioactive isotopes of her genius saying, take up my work, become Gertrude Stein. Because someone must be Gertrude Stein. Someone must save us from the literalists and realists and narratives of the beginning and end. Someone must be a river that can type. And why not I? Gertrude is insisting on the fact that while I am a subgenius weighing 105 pounds and living in a small town with an enormous furry male husband who is always in his Cadillac Eldorado, driving off to sell something to people who do not deserve the bad luck of this merchandise in their lives, that these facts would not be a problem for Gertrude Stein. Gertrude and I feel that, for instance, in patriarchal poetry, when, like an avalanche that can type, she is burying the patriarchy, still there persists a sense of condescending affection. So while I'm a thin heterosexual subgenius, nevertheless, Gertrude has chosen me as her tool, just as she chose the patriarchy as a tool for ending the patriarchy. And because I have become her tool now, in a sense, Gertrude is inside me. It's tough. Having Gertrude inside me is like having swallowed an ocean liner that can type. And while I feel like a very small coat closet with a bear in it, Gertrude and I feel that I must tell you that Gertrude does not care. She is using me to get her message across to say, I am lost. I am beset by literalists and narratives of the beginning and middle and end. Help me. And so, yes, I say yes. I am here, Gertrude, because we feel, Gertrude and I, that there is real urgency in our voice, like a sob that can type, and that things are very bad for her because she is lost, beset by the literalists and realists, her own enormousness crushing her, and we must find her and take her into ourselves, even though I am the least likely of saviors and have been chosen perhaps as a last resort. Yes, definitely. Gertrude is saying to me, you are the least likely of saviors. You are my last choice and my last resort. Thank you.